Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast. Until very recently, this was the natural state of humanity, darkness. In the 200,000 years of human existence, only 0.06% of that time has known electric light. There were candles and there were torches, but the thought of merely just flipping a switch to turn on all the lights in the room was completely foreign. Today, we recognize the shapes of cities based on the lights that they shine at our satellites. Electricity is everywhere. Here in Europe, it's like oxygen. We would never even consider paying money to plug in our laptop or our mobile phone when we're at the airport or cafe to charge it. But what's really important to recognize is that this year, in 2009, 130 years after the invention of the electric light bulb, the technology still hasn't spread everywhere. These students are studying at an airport because it's the only place in their city where electric light is reliable and consistent. There are many major cities in parts of Africa, in Monrovia, for example, in Liberia, that have no electric grid. All power is from generators. This is Thomas Edison's patent for the electric lamp. And it was a very ingenious invention, but it had one major problem from a business perspective. And that is, to use an electric lamp, you need electricity, which didn't really exist at the time for most businesses and most homes. So Thomas Edison, being the very smart guy that he is, he says, okay, I'm going to build an electric power generator, and I'm going to give electricity to homes and businesses. So Thomas Edison came up with the Pearl Street Station, and he would use direct current to transmit this electricity from the Pearl Street Station in New York to a very small neighborhood. You can see it there on the right-hand side. And that would distribute electricity to households and businesses, and it was a huge hit. Everyone did it immediately. And you can see there were people that were piling coal into the furnace, and that was making the electricity. The thing about direct current, however, is that it's not a very efficient way to transmit electricity. It loses a lot of electricity on the way. So in order to distribute electricity using direct current, you have to have lots of power generating plants in every single neighborhood all over the world. It's a very decentralized technology. Now, Thomas Edison was America's greatest inventor at the time, and not many people were willing to challenge his thinking on how things should be done and what was the right way to do it. But there's one exception. Of course, he's an Austrian. Actually, he was Serbian, but he was part of the Austrian Empire at the time. This is Nikola Tesla. And he said, you know what, Edison, I don't think that direct current is the way to do things. I've got this new idea, it's called alternating current, and you can transmit electricity very far distances without losing much. You lose maybe 5-10%. And this allowed for a centralization of electricity, so you could have huge power generating plants and transmit that electricity over very far areas. What resulted in the next 10 years, Nikola Tesla actually moved to New York. He had a very interesting life. He moved to New York, and there was this war. He teamed up with George Westinghouse, and there was a war of currents between direct current and alternating current, between Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, between America's greatest inventor at the time and Europe's greatest inventor of the time. And who lost that war? Topsy the elephant lost the war. The thing about alternating current is that in order to send this electricity over long distances, you need to really crank up the voltage while you send it these long distances. Then it gets to wherever it's going to, and you lower the voltage again, and it can get distributed to different households. And Thomas Edison wanted to use a scare tactic, which is very popular in America, and especially with American politics. And he said, you know, on these high voltage cables, while they're going, if anyone touches it, they will get electrocuted immediately. Even an elephant would get electrocuted. So if you don't like seeing videos of elephants getting electrocuted, I imagine I would recommend that you look down for about 20 seconds. This is poor Topsy meeting her end, thanks to Thomas Edison, a very cruel marketing ploy. There we have Topsy, and there we have no more Topsy. Poor Topsy. In the end, it wasn't Topsy, but it was Niagara Falls that sealed the deal for Nikola Tesla and for alternating current. This is why now on our laptop computers we have AC adapters and not DC adapters. Niagara Falls at the time was the largest power generating plant in the world, and they needed to find a way to transmit this incredible amount of energy that they were creating to parts of Ontario and New York State, and alternating current was really the only way to do that. If we didn't use alternating current, then projects like China's Three Gorges Dam would not exist because it wouldn't make any sense to make that much energy in one central place if you could only distribute it to a small area, or you would lose most of the electricity that you actually make. Just for the record, Three Gorges Dam will be producing 10 times as much electricity as Niagara Falls per second. I bring up the history of electricity briefly because it so closely parallels the history of computing, and especially what we're seeing as we enter this third phase, the new phase of computing, which is cloud computing. This is a mainframe computer. I think the mainframe computers were the first phase of computing. If you don't count the human computers that existed before them, that would just do the mathematical equations. A computer like this is the Control Data 3600 that was made in 1963. As you can see, it had a 0.483 megahertz CPU, had 1.5 megabytes of memory, which was gigantic at the time. It was used by the Internal Revenue Service in the United States to process taxes during the 60s, and computers like this cost between $500,000 and $1 million. If you were a programmer or a computer science or an academic, you had to wait in long lines in order to use these computers because there weren't that many of them. 1977 brought about the second phase of computing. This is the personal computer. This is when computers entered households and regular businesses, and just a normal person at his or her desk could use an Apple II computer, for example, as we see in this 1977 ad from Scientific American. This was the second page of the ad. The Apple I was really just what people would buy at a science fair that they could kind of hack, but the Apple II was the first enclosed personal computer. It used audio cassette tapes to store data. The first Apple II cost $1,300 if you wanted 4K of RAM, and $2,600 if you wanted 48K of RAM. The advertisement also says that it has high-resolution graphics, by which it means a 280 by 192 pixel display, and it has four colors, black, white, violet, and green. The advertisement also says that it handily plugs into any normal TV with an inexpensive modulator, which is not supplied, so you have to pick that up at Radio Shack. Most of us are like this guy. This is Gary. He works in an IT department at a major company, and he, for me, represents kind of the personal computing era that most of us are still in. It's Gary's job to go around in his office and update all of the software on each of the computers. Every time a new version comes out, he has to go around. When a new employee comes, he has to create a new email address for that employee. He looks over all of the servers for the company. If you think about it, the way that computing is working in a lot of corporations and the way that Gary is employed is a lot like the Pearl Street Station. It's a very decentralized system. He's looking after a small network. And most of us are like this. Most of us still store our documents on our own hard drives, on our computers. When we share and collaborate on those documents, we do it via email. Most of us don't actually create information on the internet. Usually we use the internet to share that information. But we're at the transition to a new era of computing, and I think one of the most concrete pieces of evidence that shows that this is happening is the netbook computer. For the first time in the history of computing, computers are not becoming more powerful, they're actually becoming less powerful. And that's because you don't need a powerful computer anymore. If you have a simple netbook computer like this, which is running Linux, which you can get for anywhere from $200 to $500, all you need to be able to do is open up your browser and connect to the internet, and you can use Photoshop online, you can use Google Documents. Any application, even video editing that you have on your own computer, a similar application is now available online. It's not just netbook computers. More frequently, we are leaving our laptops and our computers at home, and we're just taking our smartphones with us, because those smartphones connect to the internet. And we can do many of the tasks that we were doing from our laptops using our phones. The biggest talk of the town these days is the new Apple tablet that everyone thinks will be coming out, if not next week, then sometime early next year. And people have been talking about an Apple tablet computer for a long time, but it wouldn't have made any sense to produce 5 years ago because all it is a screen, right? You have a screen, you have a keyboard on that screen that you can use, and a microphone and a camera. But that's what's different about the era of cloud computing is that's all you need. You don't need a powerful computer. As long as you're able to connect to the cloud with this one little screen, then you can do just about anything. So, the cloud. What do we mean by the cloud? In many ways, I think it's an abstraction that's not very useful because it expresses, it's a symbol for real infrastructure that's taking place and for a real infrastructural shift that's happening in computing. When we say the cloud, we mean guys like this. For a long time, Google was very secretive about their data centers. We're talking about gigantic data centers of 40,000 to 50,000 computers. Each of these little boxes that you see that he's installing there, that's actually a computer that Google has. And he's giving us a tour of the data center. The internet right now takes up 5% of the global energy supply. And these data centers, because they have so many computers that they're running constantly, their biggest concern is maintaining temperature. They often build these things by very large, cool rivers so that they're able to cool down the computers. Here he's looking into the AC and to make sure to keep the computers cold. This is one individual Google server. For a long time, it was a mystery how they did their things. They then made a video and showed it. When we upload documents to Google Docs, when we upload pictures to Picasa, and Picasa then resizes those pictures for us or lets us edit our pictures, our email, if you're checking your email on Gmail right now, it's taking place here. It's taking place on Google server. It's not taking place on your computer. You're just interacting with it through your browser. That's cloud computing. It's you using computers elsewhere from your own computer through the browser. Where do those computers exist? This is a map of massive data centers around the world from datacentermap.com. And you can see Africa doesn't have many right now, but when we talk about the cloud, we're not talking about the rain clouds that were outside for the past couple days. We're talking about these data centers with thousands and thousands of servers that are processing all of the applications that we use every day on the internet. When we talk about the internet, this is it. Now, actually, these are the submarine cables that connect the internet from country to country. It doesn't show the satellite internet connections, which are becoming more frequent, and it doesn't show the fiber optics that are spread across the countries on land. The darker the country, the more bandwidth it uses. You can see the United States, Western Europe, Brazil uses a lot, China uses a lot, other countries not as much. And this is us. We are the internet users. As many people have been talking about this week, it is the 40th anniversary of the internet. It is the 30th anniversary of Ars Electronica. It's the 130th anniversary of the electric lamp. It is the 20th anniversary of the World Wide Web. And it is the 5th anniversary of Web 2.0. As you can see, change is accelerating. It's going faster and faster. And last year, in 2008, for the first time ever, the United States did not have the most number of users of internet. That now goes to China, and unless something very strange happens for the rest of our lifetimes, China will keep that title. $6.8 trillion were spent on e-commerce in 2008, which is something around 15% estimated of the GDP for the entire world. And this is how the internet is changing our lives. All right, sorry for the abrupt ending there. So when people ask me, well, isn't the internet just the newest technological change after the telegraph and after radio and after television? And no. It's completely different. It's affecting our lives more than any other technology has ever affected our lives before. So now we kind of have an idea of what cloud computing is and how it parallels with the history of electricity. I want to talk about another idea, which is the history of collective intelligence. Now, this is an idea that has been around in various forms for a very long time. In fact, Thomas Hobbes in the 16th century was a very controversial figure because he had this idea that intelligence doesn't come from this all-powerful God. Intelligence actually comes from regular human beings. And if you collect all of that intelligence from different human beings, then you can actually shape society in a positive way. In 1937, H.G. Wells wrote a very famous, at least in certain crowds, essay called World Brain. And this is when H.G. Wells, this is kind of at the development of microfilm, when a lot of newspapers were being put on very small, transparent film, and in one room, you could hold basically all of the newspapers that have ever been printed, or all of the books that had ever been printed. And this amazed H.G. Wells, and he thought, you know, we're actually each, all of our own ideas and our own concepts are part of something that's much larger. And there's a lot of potential there, and we can use that information in a good way. But a character who's also had a lot of really interesting ideas about collective intelligence and kind of a precursor to the internet itself, who doesn't get much attention and isn't well known, is Paul Atlet. A lot of people know about Vannevar Bush and his Memex machine in the United States, but Paul Atlet is a really interesting character. Check this guy out.
Also in 1934, Atlet publishes his most important book, The Treatise on Documentation, The Book on the Book. This is where we find the most visionary pages, where already the concept of the computer emerges.
Here, the workspace is no longer cluttered with any books. In their place, a screen and a telephone within reach. Over there, in an immense edifice, are all the books and information. From there, the page to be read, in order to know the answer to the question asked by telephone, is made to appear on the screen. A screen could be divided in half, by four, or even by ten, if multiple texts and documents had to be consulted simultaneously. There would be a loudspeaker if the image had to be complemented by oral data, and this improvement could continue to the point of automating the call for on-screen data. Cinema, phonographs, radio, television, these instruments taken as substitutes for the book will in fact become the new book. The most powerful works for the diffusion of human thought. This will be the radiated library.
Pretty cool, right? I mean, 1934, this guy's got Google Books already. It's crazy. So collective intelligence, I think we get the basis of it. It's that we're smart and that we're smarter together, and that if you can just get all of our information together in one spot, it can be used in ways that it's never been used before. Now, as we're entering the era of cloud computing, it takes on a slightly different meaning because rather than storing all of our information on individual hard drives on each of our individual computers, we're storing it in one single place where it can interact with other applications via their APIs. So what do we mean by cloud intelligence? What is collective intelligence in the era of cloud computing? Oftentimes we participate in cloud intelligence without ever knowing it. One example of this is Google Flu Trends, which if you're not feeling well, I actually just talked to a couple people who said they weren't feeling too well, so maybe they have a sore throat and they want to know what type of tea to drink when they have a sore throat. They search for that information on Google, and if enough people start searching for that information in the same town, then Google says, oh, wait a minute, there's probably a disease outbreak happening here, or a flu outbreak. And so that's one way that they're able to track trends. There have been a couple studies that have been done. This is a pretty new project. It's still experimental in a lot of ways, but a couple studies that have been done that show that this predicts flu outbreaks much better than hospitals or doctors can. But this is one of the best examples I've seen of cloud intelligence.
And unbeknownst to you, you're probably already working for Luis, fighting spam, digitizing books, and labeling images on the web. Part of Luis's master plan to mobilize the largest workforce in the history of mankind, the hundreds of millions of people who use the internet
One of the things that I'm trying to figure out is what can we do with this many people? What can you do when you can get 100 million people working on the same thing? And I think we could do amazing things. Spammers were writing programs to obtain millions of Yahoo email accounts every day because they wanted to send spam.
Luis and Manuel needed a way to tell the difference between a well-meaning Yahoo subscriber and a malicious spam computer program.
We came up with this idea of trying to give a test to figure out whether it's a human or not.
It's got to be a computerized test given to humans and computers. So the computer must be able to grade a test that it cannot pass. You know, it looks paradoxical.
What Luis and Manuel developed was CAPTCHA, a secret password that people can read, but computers can't.
I started feeling bad because each time you type a CAPTCHA, you know, the squiggly characters, essentially you waste 10 seconds of your time. And if you multiply that by 200 million, you get that humanity as a whole is wasting like 500,000 hours every day typing these annoying CAPTCHAs. I started thinking, is there a way in which we can use this human effort for something that's good for humanity? Can we make good use of those 10 seconds of your time? There's a lot of projects out there trying to digitize books. So Google has one, the Internet Archive has another one.
But there's a problem. Many of the books are old and faded. So when computers scan them, they don't recognize many of the words.
For things that were in before 1900, between 30 and 40% of the words, the computer's gonna decipher wrong.
They were written at a time when the type didn't line up always nicely, and what remnants we have of it are smudged.
Luis's solution was to take those hard-to-read words from old books and use them as CAPTCHAs. But this raised a new problem. The computer would now present a word that it could not read in the first place.
The computer didn't know what the answer was. How is it to be able to tell what the right answer is?
Luis found a solution to combine the word from an old book with a traditional CAPTCHA generated by the computer.
We'll give two tests, one that we know the answer to, one that we don't. And if the person can solve the one that we know the answer to, then we'll assume they can solve the one that we don't.
They called it ReCAPTCHA. Now, every time you type a CAPTCHA, you may very well be working for Luis, transcribing an old book.
Today, on the order of 125 to 150 books per day are being digitized because of ReCAPTCHA. It's an amazing thing.
And it's not just books. ReCAPTCHA is also transcribing the entire back archive of the New York Times.
The New York Times has this huge archive of 130 years of newspaper archive there, and we've done maybe about 20 years so far of the New York Times in the last few months, and I believe we're going to be done next year by just having people do a word at a time.
So there you go. As we're filling in comments and participating on the internet, using a 5 seconds here and 5 seconds there, we're helping digitize the New York Times and a lot of old books. Another example, unfortunately, a couple nights ago when we had the Starry, Starry Night opening here, we didn't have a Starry, Starry Night because of the clouds, and so we couldn't use the telescopes and look out in the sky, but a lot of people do that. Every single night, there's a large amateur astronomy group on Flickr, and they post images using their telescopes of what they see in the night sky. A new program called Astronometry, it has a machine robot that searches all of these pictures and looks for identifying objects in the pictures, and is then able to leave a comment on each of these photographs and also add machine tags, which you see there on the right, informing the person what they're seeing, what those planets are, what those stars are, the nebulae. And so the person gets the comment, they find out more information about what's on their picture, and Astronometry gets much more information about the night sky. So there are only, you know, however many professional observatories in the world that can only look at very small slices of the sky at any time. But there are thousands and thousands of amateur astronomers who are taking pictures of what's going on in the galaxies around us and putting them on Flickr. And so they're creating kind of a citizen watch group of what's happening in the skies and giving a lot more information to scientists. In fact, using all the amateur photographers' pictures of Comet Holmes, they were able to track the trajectory and the speed of the comet. Another example comes from San Francisco. This is from Chris Messina. As you can see, he had to go to Office Max in San Francisco, a place which he apparently doesn't like. He had to buy a dry erase board for his office. And he got there, and he was frustrated because they were overpriced. It was very difficult to find. And when he finally did find the dry erase boards, most of them were damaged. And the sales attendant wasn't very helpful, so he said, you know what, forget about this. But before he left to go somewhere else, he pulled out his iPhone, And he opened up his Amazon application on his iPhone, and he took a picture of the dry erase board. He then pressed submit, and the Amazon app sends that picture up to its servers, their massive data centers, which I showed you before. From there, it goes to a site called Mechanical Turk. This is where anyone in the world can sign up for what they call human intelligence tasks. These are real people who are doing work on Mechanical Turk. As you can see, most of them pay one penny per task that you do. For example, Jeff will pay you one penny. You could do this right now if you wanted. You could make one penny each time you go to a website and find the worship or sermon service times on that church website and then report it to Jeff, and then he'll pay you a penny. So Amazon also pays you a penny if you're willing to look at the photograph that Chris took of his dry erase board, go on to Amazon.com, find out where that product is, and then send a message back to Chris saying, oh, here's the product, it's on Amazon, here's a link to it. So a real person is doing that somewhere. Chris will never know who that person was, but somebody did it. The message got back to Chris about 20 minutes later on his cell phone, and he said, okay, here's the same dry erase boards that you were looking at. The price is lower. Chris didn't have to pay that penny. Amazon was the one who paid the penny to the person, but Chris did end up buying the dry erase boards on Amazon. Here's another example. I think all of us who have been to London, we've probably all taken pictures of Big Ben. I think it's probably the most photographed clock tower in the entire world. And 10 years ago, if we had taken those pictures, we probably would have put it in our photo album and then shown it to a few friends, maybe 5 or 10 family members, and they would have pretended that it was really interesting. These days, we put it up on Flickr or Picasa, or we use Twitter to upload it. And if you do put it up on Picasa, like thousands of people have, not only can you share it with anybody else, but it can also be used using a photosynth program to make a 3D model of the world using photographs. And so you can navigate this 3D space of using the photographs that people have taken.
Today's Stuff.tv iPhone app of the day is Shazam. Now you might have already heard of Shazam. It's a mobile phone service that you phone up, play a bit of music, and it will text you back with the song name and the artist. But the iPhone implementation is really cool. If I click on the Shazam logo, it will take me through to all the things I've already tagged with album artwork. That looks very cool. If I then play some music.
Whoops, sorry.
Okay. Now there's no phone calls or text messages here. This is all done by data.
The video stopped.
Today's Stuff.tv iPhone app of the day.
What it shows you is that if the cloud is the world brain, as H.G. Wells kind of talked about and as I think others will talk about today, then the cameras and microphones on our cell phones and our computers are the eyes and the ears of this brain, of the cloud. And so you can use your cell phone. We've all been in a cafe and we've heard some song that we really liked, but we had no idea what it was. Maybe we asked around and no one was able to tell us. Now you can just hold up the microphone of your cell phone, listen to the song, and then in about 5 seconds, the cloud will send you back a message and say, this is what you're listening to. And it'll also provide you a link to the YouTube video. It'll tell you if the person is playing a concert in your area at any time. All of the information that is available online can get linked together and give you a lot more. So the cloud provides you with this information. You, in turn, provide the cloud, and particularly this service, this company, with information about who's listening to what where. And in the United States, I guess Jay Sean featuring Lil Wayne is the most identified song by this application in the US. In Austria, the most identified song right now is I Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas. And so you can eventually, you'll be able to look neighborhood by neighborhood and see who's listening to what or who wants to find out about what. Google just opened up a new application for Android and for Palm cell phones called Google Traffic, and this provides you with information about if there's heavy traffic and you're on the way to work, you can open this up and it will tell you alternate paths. So maybe you're on a road where there's a lot of heavy traffic for some reason, you don't understand why, but you don't know where there isn't traffic. There's no way for you to know that, but now there is. You can go onto this app and it'll say, actually on this road, if you turn left and then turn right there, it's really light traffic right now. In turn for doing that, for getting that information, you're telling your location to Google servers every 2 seconds or so. So it measures the speed on the road where you are, and it updates its information. As you can see, there's this symbiotic relationship that's forming between humans and between the cloud. It also allows for new forms of creativity. In the past, to create a movie that had actors in 50 different countries would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to do. Today, you can do it for free. And in the past, there was only one man in the world who could attract millions of viewers of him dancing the moonwalk. Today, we all can. This was a movie that was made in commemoration of Michael Jackson. He's the first one to do the dance. And then all of these people from Brazil, from, I don't know where, maybe that's in Germany, from all over the world, they submitted these videos, thousands of them, of doing the moonwalk. And it's a really cool collaboration that's done because YouTube is free, because our computers all have these webcams, and because it's just so easy to participate. All right, I don't think we have time for this one. This is a pretty well-known visualization of the internet. It's by the Opte Project, and this is us, which this is the internet, this is all of the users, and what we have to remember is that there is no internet without people. The internet is a network of computers, yes, but it's a network of computers with human hands lying on those keyboards. And when we talk about the future of collective intelligence or cloud intelligence, it's difficult to know what all of this is going to bring. But what we do know is that all intelligence has always been collective. Whether it's the collective actions of proteins as they produce our DNA, or it's the collective actions of the billions of neurons in our brain as they produce the thoughts that we're all thinking right now, they're all collective actions. What's interesting is that each of those billion neurons in our brain that's forming the thoughts in our head, they're probably not aware that they're part of something that's much larger. Just like all of the millions and billions of internet users realize that they're part of an internet, but don't realize that collectively they make up one body. In many ways, cloud computing, cloud intelligence is bringing a centralization of power because we are trusting our privacy and security and our data to just a few major corporate vendors. And I think there's cause for alarm there. I think some of the speakers today will bring that up. On the other hand, it's creating an architecture of participation where any of us can use tools to become vocal citizens and to become part of a global democracy. In the past, this podium where I'm standing right now used to be the one sole symbol of power in this room. I speak and you guys are supposed to listen. Today, that power is actually right over there on that screen. Those are the people who can participate using Twitter, and you can say whatever you want in this room. You don't even have to be in this room. You can participate from anywhere, and I hope that you do. Anyone who uses a post a Twitter message today with the tag RsCloud, as you can see up there, will go in the room. And this conference, this discussion that's taking place today, isn't just about the amazing speakers who are going to be speaking up here, who I hope that you all pay a lot of attention to, but it's what the entire room is thinking. It's what we can all contribute to the conversation, and you can do so on that screen. This morning, we have a really tremendous group of speakers who are going to be talking about some very fascinating issues. Stephen Downs is a Canadian senior researcher at the National Research Council of Canada, specializing in the fields of online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy. Downs is perhaps best known for his daily newsletter, OL Daily. Ethan Zuckerman is the co-founder of Global Voices, an online editorialized aggregator of blogs from around the world, and is a senior researcher at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. And Anders Sandberg is a researcher, futurist, transhumanist, and author. He holds a PhD in computer science from Stockholm University in computational neuroscience, and is currently a James Martin Research Fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. I know they're going to share some amazing thoughts with us, and I hope that all of us in this room share amazing thoughts using Twitter and just in conversation. Thank you very much.